I'm Drew Miller, and you're listening to The Second Muse. Lately, I've been playing a new game. It's called How Many of My Favorite Albums Did Ben Shive Work On? I haven't arrived at a final number yet because that number keeps growing. The reason for that is because Ben is such a remarkably gifted collaborator. Whether he's writing a heartbreaking strings arrangement, helping craft an album from scratch, or making the piano sing like no one else, his magic touch is unmistakable. Ben is also an inventive songwriter. His album, The Cymbal Crashing Clouds, plays like a fantasia of dreamlike sequences whose underlying logic doesn't show itself overtly, yet hits just the right spot. One striking example is the song The Fire Pit, which we'll discuss in this episode. I hope you come away from this conversation with some exciting new idea in your head, and I hope you'll join me in my new game. You might just be surprised at how many of your favorite songs have passed through Ben's hands on their way to your ears. Ben, thank you so much for coming and talking with me about The Cymbal Crashing Clouds.
Thanks.
I am especially excited that it now is taking the form of vinyl.
That's so cool.
And it feels really right. I actually listened to the proof of the vinyl.
Yeah.
To make sure that it worked before it got pressed a lot. I was like, oh boy, I get to take this home and test this album on my record player.
Yeah.
And that was a great homework assignment for me. I was really excited about it. So
yeah. Man, I just love looking at that very busy album cover in a space that lets it be a busy album cover.
Right, yeah. It needs to be big.
Yeah, it didn't really work super well, even on a jewel case. It always just looked a little wrong to me, but I love it.
It needs to be this,
I love
massive,
it on the vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we thought about actually simplifying the album cover for the vinyl, and I'm so glad we didn't, because I just think it looks so fun and cool. And
you can sprawl out a little bit now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I am coming at this as someone who knows very little about the story of The Cymbal Crashing Clouds, and so I'm kind of a blank slate, and I'm going to sort of act as a blank slate for listeners who have stumbled on this amazing adventure of a record and just want to know how it came to be.
That's so
exist.
Sweet.
So just go for it. Tell me what you want to tell me.
Think what there is to be told about that record was just that my goal was to write a record where every song was about something. It was about two things. It was about the thing that it was about on the surface, and then there was something else that it was speaking to.
Okay.
So, an example of that would be Every Good Boy Does Fine is sort of a parable about me getting fired by my piano teacher and discovering the Beatles.
Yeah.
And learning to love music. And then it's also about the law of Moses and about the New Covenant. So, that's a good example.
So you set out to write an album where there were two levels of meaning, a sort of parable format on purpose. And that was sort of a structure that you gave yourself.
Yeah, I did. And I mean, I was thinking about the scripture where, Jesus, I guess he's quoting, I don't remember where the original is from, but when Jesus says, I'm opening my mouth in parables so that they may be ever hearing and never understanding. And I don't think I've ever, it's not in the lyric sheet, so you probably wouldn't know this if you'd heard it, but there's a background vocal in Every Good Boy Does Fine, in the chorus, the background vocal goes, so I will open my mouth in riddles and rhymes, and I will give them deaf ears and blind their eyes. And that was kind of in my mind, I just kind of wanted to make a record where it was listen if you want to. Listen closely if you want to. Or just hear what's on the surface,
And how do you interpret that then? Because that can certainly be a hang-up for just someone reading the gospel being okay, so Jesus, why did
does he want me to hear or does he not?
Do you really, do you want me to understand it? Are you being confusing on purpose?
Yeah, and so why did Jesus, why do you think Jesus spoke in parables?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I'm interviewing you.
Yeah, but I want to hear what you think.
I mean, even just from what you just said about kind of the way that you articulated this idea of the purpose of a parable as like, if you really want to listen, you know?
Yeah.
The way that I heard that even just now was like, it's like a built-in filter, mm-hmm. like a built-in BS filter for the listener. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to say it this way so that the people who really desire to hear will hear. They will find it. I'm not going to abuse the truth in such a way that I have to make it palatable or dilute it in mm-hmm. order for as many people as possible to understand it. Like, yeah. I think in our time today, like, we've inherited from like the Enlightenment and all kinds of places, just this sort of like utilitarian, like pragmatic approach to like, we want as many people to be able to understand as much as possible at once. Like, it's yeah. just this very like, you know,
yeah.
streamlined
yeah.
sort of paradigm. And so the idea of someone, especially of Jesus, you know, speaking in parables specifically to make sure that what he's saying is not just kind of mindlessly consumed by as many people as possible.
Yeah. The fact that you have to bring offensive. Some of yourself to it.
It's scandalous to us to think that you wouldn't try yeah, to go right. out of your way to make sure that everybody understands what you're saying.
Totally. Well, I mean, yeah. when people in our culture want to learn something, they often pick up a book that's written to teach you something. And I find that these books often are like, the first chapter is, here's my premise. And the rest of the chapters are, here's my premise played out here. Here's my premise played out here. Just like the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I mean, and there's a place for that. And I've been helped by many of those books. But it seems like what Jesus is saying is like, what I want you to learn is best learned if I talk about something else.
It's like we all carry around these like interpretive crutches.
Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe like whenever.
What is that? What do you mean by that?
I mean that like we lean on certain ways of hearing.
Okay.
So even in our last interview, like I'm thinking of how when we were talking with Jeremy, you said something about like holding scripture in one hand and like the pedestrian phrase in the other. What that accomplishes is it kind of jolts you as the listener into yeah. paying attention, because no longer can you lean on your reflexive, pious Bible ears
yeah.
to like, oh yeah, nice, good, like Bible phrase.
Right.
Because that's not listening.
Yeah.
And so what that's what I mean by sort of interpretive crutches. It's
yeah.
like we're all walking around with that.
Yeah.
And so maybe sometimes the best way around that is to talk about something else entirely.
Yeah.
And trust that they
have to
do
with one
another.
Well, it's like what Jesus is giving his listeners is a living thing. So that mm-hmm. it can instead of telling them something specific that he wants them to learn, he's giving them something that's a picture and that will pop up in lots of different situations
mm-hmm.
and will translate to lots of places.
Yeah.
And I also agree that part of the reason he's giving them this is because he wants them to listen. He's telling them to listen, which I mean, that's so the first song on the record is called Listen. And I think that like, and it's a song about me hearing it. I was actually up in Maryland and I stepped out of a front door to go catch a plane at like 5 a.m. and this train whistle blew and it sounded, it was just this gorgeous sound. And I had this realization that the, what I was hearing, it had this extremely long tail, you know, the sound did,
mm-hmm.
it like just kept on going. And I realized, oh my gosh, that means that it's just bouncing off everything in the town. Like that train blew its whistle and it was so loud of a sound that it bounced off everything everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that that resonated with me as, that's funny, resonated, it's what it was doing, resonated with me as like, oh yeah, you know, Jesus' words, since he gave us these parables, they just bounce off of everything. They just kind of,
that's really good.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? They can resonate yeah. in so many places.
Yeah.
And, but you have to, you know, you have to listen, you have to be willing to hear it. And, yeah. and so, yeah, in that song at the end, it talks about like, The lyric is something like, okay, well, how does it go? Signal the symbol crashing clouds, pluck all the steeples and spires, cue the rivers with the reeds in their mouths, conduct the electrical choirs. Like, talking about all these things that are around the town and just saying, like, make these things come alive with your voice. So that's kind of what that record is about. That's where my head was at the time.
Yeah. And this idea of resonance, I think, when you're talking about listening and what it means to listen, as opposed to a self-help book. Mm-hmm. What the self-help book offers is a premise you can apply to your life objectively without having to be changed personally by it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Whereas this parable version, or this way of telling the truth through parable, if you're going to listen, you have to be willing to be changed in the process of listening. And that's what resonance is. These things are, you know, they're participating in what they're resonating in. But that being said, like, if that's what parables are, then the fire pit, I'm listening and I'm like, okay,
yeah,
maybe I'm one of the ones who doesn't I'm like trying to understand.
Yeah.
And that's where I have to have you come and say, I will tell it to you plainly. Well, oh, you crooked generation, so let me tell you.
Actually, so we were at a friend from college's house. That was a mess of a sentence. We were at this guy, Josh Wright's house, my wife and I, over Christmas, and their daughter had been burned. He spent this whole summer building this fire pit, and on the night that they christened it, their little girls were playing beside it, and their daughter like tripped over something and fell into the fire pit. And they scooped her out really quick, and when they brought her into the house, like, one of them like went, ugh, like, and when the breath came out of their mouth, it like, they saw her skin go like with fire. I mean, it was just like this nightmare for them of just like, our daughter is burning, you know, that, she was burned up her leg and on her back. And so he told the story about how he wanted to board it up. Like the lyric says, boarded up and aborted, damned and abandoned. He wanted to just put a ugly piece of plywood over the thing and be like, screw you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like curse it.
Yeah.
And basically say, this is what you get for hurting my daughter. You know what I mean? Like to an inanimate thing, but you can see how that would be a reaction.
Oh, of course.
Like, let this thing remain there just ugly as a way of punishing it for the way that it hurt my daughter. But then he thought better of it and he was like, no, we're going to redeem it. We're going to redeem this thing. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a place where my family is going to celebrate, and we're going to remember the grief. We're going to remember something bad that happened in this spot, but we're gonna let God redeem this thing. And so I guess that's the parable that's in it, is like, what do we do with the world? What do we do with our suffering?
Yeah, do we curse?
Do we say
it,
like, yeah? Do we curse the world,
or do we,
and just say like, you just get uglier and uglier, I hate you? Or do we say like, no, I'm gonna move into this space, and I'm gonna move into my suffering, and I'm gonna say, hey, let's experience beautiful things here. Let's see God redeem this. So that's what, that's how that song, I guess, is a parable.
What's the last line of the fire pit?
A little girl's chasing fireflies, so close to the open flame, so perfectly unafraid.
So close to the open flame, so perfectly unafraid.
Yeah. That song was pretty unique because a lot of that record was laborious to write. A lot of those songs took me a year or something to write, you know, from the inception. But that song actually is I wrote it as a free verse poem, and then I decided that I was going to make the music conform to the poetry.
Yeah,
which, and so I,
that you did.
So I think there, I could be wrong. There may be some like odd bars in there or something.
Yeah, no, there are.
So I very much wanted to go like, and actually, I remember actually the night writing this melody, I was walking around in my yard. And I was just like, I'm going to put one note at a time into this melody and just kind of go where does the lyric want it to go? And I literally, there was no like, I'm just sitting around and singing and this melody came out. It was like, what's the next note? What's the next note? You know? which is odd for me. I know it's not normally how I write a melody, probably. It's probably a little more intuitive and flowy than that. But with this song, I wanted to make sure that each note was just, like, conveyed as much as it could. And so I'm trying to think. There's a spot. I was thinking about it on the way here. When my little girl fell into the fire pit, skin was ash, like, duh. Like, those that's a tritone, which is, like, the, you know, the scary interval, right?
Right.
And so I just kind of wanted to make sure that, like, those things were just as evocative and sort of supported the lyric as well as they could.
There's a lot of dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the interval of the whole song, like, the... It's just the seven, like the,
yeah, that's
the
right.
seventh is constant. And
yeah,
that is,
so I wish we had a piano in here.
Most, you know, basically what I mean by that is like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, and
imagine
actually,
if I just stayed here and didn't go back to the one.
Yeah, and not only is the seven going on, but my right hand is playing a one and a seven the whole time.
Yeah, and those are right up next to each other.
So it's like they're actually, yeah, they're a second apart, but okay. I'm playing them as a seventh.
Yeah.
But so as the whole, the chord progression is going, my right hand isn't moving at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that the lyric is structured is there's a turning point.
Mm.
In the waiting room with shaky hands, long before the awful panic passed, I can't talk, I softened.
Mm.
And that's when the redemption happens,
softens.
Is when this guy's heart softens. Yeah, and so up to that point, first of all, there's this major seventh going on in the right hand of the piano. And also, at some point, the strings enter and they immediately go, like they start like playing like sirens, like fire truck sirens,
mm-hmm.
Like just doing all this awful cacophony thing. And then at the moment he says soften, they all congeal and they all hit one. They converge would be a better word. They all hit one pitch.
Yeah.
And it's the gateway to a new thing. And actually, after that in the song, the right hand is not only playing the seventh, but it plays that seventh much of the time still.
Yeah.
But the harmony has changed.
So it's like, surrounded
the
by
weird thing
notes.
About that seventh interval is it's actually, it's what brings the color to this, to what we would call a major seventh chord. So if you sit down at the piano right now and you play a C and an E and a G and a B, you'll
it's
hear the
sound
kind
of
chord
of Christmas.
I'm talking about. It's a really right. beautiful, colorful sound, which is, you know, a great metaphor for what we're talking about here is that like the struggle and the pain is what brings the beauty and the growth and the warmth, right? So after that point in the song, that interval is happening much of the time, but it's happening over a chord progression that is not meant to be haunting and awful. It's meant to be warm and beautiful.
It's contextualized.
Yeah.
It's made sense of.
Yeah.
And in a way, you could say it's redeemed. You've
redeemed
the interval of the seventh from
dissonance
and placed it harmonically in a place.
Yeah.
I mean, like that note is almost like it is the fire pit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is... And not that it's that easy to do that with your own life. You know, you don't...
No, right, but
it's
does.
A great image. It's a great, example of what we should try to do.
Yeah. Man, a couple of things I want to point out, actually, before we listen. One of them is that there's this organ that is all over the record, and it is always playing as sort of Bach as I can make it be. It's always supposed to sound a little bit Baroque.
Yeah.
So there's a very, like, Baroque is a word for, you know, that we use to describe Bach's music. And one thing that's true about Baroque music is very true about this record, and that's that it's ornate. Mm. So this record, I think, to a fault, is just like, I just went, everything is always going to be happening on this record. Which I think some of that was just a reaction to the fact that as a producer, I'm never allowed to do that. So I think mm-hmm. I was just like, I'm just going to do it. You know, I'm just going to, like, put in all the things that I want
to
do, and I'm going
to
take very few of them out. Yeah. So you'll hear that organ in there. Also, this track is kind of a lift of Thom Yorke's Eraser record, which was like a radio, you know, he's the Radiohead guy.
Yeah.
And he had made a solo record around the time that I made this record.
Yeah.
And so the programming sounds very much like it. But one thing that's going on in the rhythm is that Paul Mabry played a drum pass and it's panned off to the left.
Yeah, the drums are
all.
And
then panned off to the right is I double timed his drum pass.
Oh!
And then I put that on the right
side. No way.
And then I must have edited it, obviously, otherwise it would only be half the length of the song.
Oh, shoot.
So you hear on one side the drums, and then on the other side the double time drums.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it just sounds like you're having so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Which, man, like, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Just like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And yeah. Knowing what that drum, what the drums are in the right side now, I'm just like,
yeah.
Yes.
Kind of fun. You know, the only thing I'd say is, you just said, let's do it. And I think the one thing that's missing from that record for me is the let's. Like, because I kind of fell prey to the, I think, very current sentiment of, like, you know what's cool is a guy going in a room by himself and making a record. Mm-hmm. Like, I just kind of did that. And I mean, there's other people playing on the record for sure, but, like, mm-hmm. I am the producer and the artist on the record.
Yeah.
And that's cool, you know, because I got to... No, it's not cool. You know, it's mm-hmm. actually not. It's like, mm-hmm. it's kind of sad to me that, like, there's no one for me to celebrate with about that, about what's mm-hmm. good about the record other than myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like... So, I mean, I would just say, like, you know, I work with lots of people who could produce their own records. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad they come to me, not just so that I can have a living, but so that they can, like, get to collaborate. Get to, mm-hmm. you know, it's just much, it's part of what making music is supposed to be. So, that's like, you know, when the dust settles, that's the only thing I regret about this record is that I don't have anybody to share it with in terms of, like... Remember when we did that amazing thing together? It's more like, I did stuff by myself, and it's cool.
It's just you, like, toasting yourself in a room.
Yeah, right?
Like, oh,
sounds lonely,
that?
Doesn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah,
it
is. Great. Yeah. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, I know.
Why, yes.
Whereas I made my first solo record, first of two, with Kaysen, and, like, you know, happy memories, and you know, somebody to spur me on and make me better, and all that stuff, so, yeah. But I don't want to water down what you were saying is that, yeah, I really did enjoy just being like, let's go. Let's be a little crazy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think if I was to make another record, I probably wouldn't do it this way, but I'm glad I did.
Something that's just fascinating to me to watch in other people and in myself is just like, I feel like everybody needs like a few different kinds of spaces in which to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we usually typecast ourselves into a certain role that like is the main one, which is good. Mm-hmm. Like, sure, like you need to have a voice that's dependable and like, this is how I sound, this is what I'm doing, this is, you know, a missional thing, and that's serious for good reasons. But you also need, everybody needs to do something by themselves sometimes, and everybody needs to do something with other people. There's yeah. like, there's sort of a, anytime it becomes a monoculture of like,
oh yeah,
there's just this one thing I do.
Yeah.
It becomes riskier and, less healthy and more sort of prone to
that's corruption.
So like,
I will think about that.
Just this yeah. idea that like, there's all these ways to be creative that like, I think we all kind of need, and I don't know, I haven't yeah. really thought about it more than
yeah.
that right now.
But. I definitely, I mean, I haven't made a solo record in a lot of years, and plenty of good reasons for that. But, the one thing that's sad about it to me is that, yeah, there's no place, you know, in my life for that kind of like, that kind of expression and that kind of really adventuring.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, most of the time that I'm making a record for somebody, it's they're doing the adventuring.
They're going on an adventure.
And I'm carrying their luggage.
You
I'm
got figuring the map. Out.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, we could go here.
Yeah.
I'll be your tour guide.
So I actually don't put that high of a premium on self-expression. I think that is plenty explored in our culture. I'm not right, too worried about anybody yeah. not expressing themselves.
Yeah, but we know to do that. Yeah. Someone needs to tell us to do something else.
Yeah, and yet I do think, you know, one thing that I regret about not making solo records right now is that God gave me a certain lyrical sensibility and musical sensibility that I value. I like them, and I don't have a place for them. You know what I mean? I do in little ways. You know, when I'm working on people's records, I get to be like, ooh, what about this? You know, but that's always going to be tempered by what they need it to be and how it needs to be shaped around who they are, you know,
yeah.
which is great. I am glad that most of my life is actually about realizing other people's goals.
Yeah, like, something beautiful.
I think that's good, right? I mean,
yeah.
But I just, especially lyrically, there's no place for the kind of lyric that I write. And so I'm trying to figure that one out because, you know, when I'm songwriting with people for their records, I don't write the lyric. I mean, I might every once in a while submit a word or two, but they need to write the lyric because right. they're going to sing it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's like it needs to come from their soul. And so a lyric like Listen or Every Good Boy Does Fine or whatever, those kind of lyrics that I don't think, you know, this isn't. It's not a brag. I don't think anybody else would write it. You know, like nobody else is looking for that exact thing that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's true of everybody. Like when you're really, actually, you know, this is a tangent, but I was just reading East of Eden, and there's this whole paragraph that's amazing where Steinbeck says that like, with the turn of the 20th century, there was this with mass production. He was like, mass production is going to work its way into all the things that we do. It's going to work into the making of our food, prophetic.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to work into creativity. And he
again,
goes,
prophetic.
Here's the thing. There's a spark that exists in a man. There's a thing that happens in the soul of an individual. And he was like, that's the originator of great art. It's like, it comes from inside of the person, like their unique whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and he kind of just like very unequivocally says, nothing creative and good will ever come out of a room with a few people in it. Like, Which I mean...
Against co-writing.
Yeah, John right? Steinbeck, I mean, it's a right? strong word against co-writing, and I would obviously temper that. And I think there are situations where co-writing can be great. However, I do think that there's a certain kind of art that will never come out of a co-write, you know? Yeah. Even like when you think about the Beatles, they weren't co-writing. They were writing a song and bringing it to the other one to have yeah. the other one tell them it wasn't good
and maybe
enough.
Maybe that's a version of co-writing that might be
yeah.
one of the best versions.
I'm very interested in that version. Yeah, I would like, yeah, I've got a project I'm going to be working on next year with somebody, and I'm going to be a part of the writing process, but I think the way that I need to be a part of the writing process is just being the person that they bring the song to yeah. when they think it's done, and I get yeah. to be the one who says
not done,
no it ain't, you know. And the thing is that's not financially expedient for me, because I probably won't be listed as a co-writer on songs. I don't care. Like, if you want to make something great, you yeah. know.
There's, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I'm fascinated that you're talking about your lyrical instincts, because I think in listening to The Cymbal Crash and Clouds, like, I mean, it's no secret that your musical instincts you can bring to everything you do. And, like, we all know, like, how brilliant you are musically, you know. But, like, listening to those lyrical instincts, there's a cohesion between the two that's just, like, this unbroken intuition that's wow. just, like... whoa, thanks.
That's awesome.
And like, so just you. To kind of affirm what you're saying of like, thanks. Yeah, no one else would think of that. And it's like, no one else would think of that. So like, please keep thinking of it, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm
thinking about that. I don't know how to do it, but I feel like there's some place, you know. Yeah, I'm interested in like, how could I write the kind of songs that I want to write but not have to sing them, because I don't have a lot of joy in singing. Like, it actually costs me something. somebody was telling me about this idea of soul points the other day. It's like singing, like there's some producer who talks about them.
So
you can go look it up. Some producer talks about how he's like, he assigns soul points to all his tasks. And he's like, well, this one costs me 20 soul points and this one gets me 30, you know? So singing is something that costs me soul points. And
that's
I'm like,
so
how
helpful.
Could I write the kind of lyrics that I want to write, which gives me a lot of soul points without having to sing them?
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That reminds me, my, I don't know where this comes from. I feel like it must have originated somewhere else, but, like, it's one of those things that just makes no sense, but for some reason, keep saying it. Like, I think, yeah, like, my wife and her boss, they just work together all the time. They're like a duo and they're, nonprofit, and they talk about having a certain amount of spoons going into every day.
Okay.
And they're like, I have one spoon left. And I'm not going to spend my spoon.
Oh my gosh, like,
it's
man.
Completely arbitrary that it's a spoon. I don't
Dude.
Know what that, you know.
Man, I'll
but
tell
it's
you
like,
what.
You only ever go into a day with so many spoons.
That's
you know
amazing.
I mean? And like, knowing that, whatever your language is for it, like soul points.
Dude, okay, let's talk about that for anything. Just a couple minutes. I know we got to go.
Yeah, we're fine.
But man, the idea of Sabbath, I think is so far-reaching. Like, I think it goes everywhere, and it doesn't just go to one day a week, even though I think one day a week is probably important. But I think, like, gosh, I'm learning, I'm realizing, dude, I read this Wendell Berry quote. You've ever heard of him? Just kidding. I read this Wendell Berry quote in Remembering, where the character in Remembering pulls off to the side of the road because he sees this Amish farmer with a team of mules or whatever.
Yeah.
He's just been, contextually, he's just been to visit this very corporate farmer,
sure.
and it has disturbed and grossed him out so much to talk to this man. So our main character, having just talked to this man, sees this other guy, this Amish guy, on the side of the road with a team of mules, and he decides to pull over and talk to him.
Yeah.
And he talks to him, and the guy, and he says, "Are you able to get enough work done with a team of mules plowing in a day?" And the guy says, "No, the mules keep me from doing too much." And he talks about this guy's farm, and he says it was a place of work and of rest, where work was done in a spirit of thanksgiving. Like, there's more to the quote than that, but it, you know, that's huge to me, because for years I have pushed myself too hard, and I have hurt myself, like, you know, just to not sleep in at night and doing all that stuff just to meet my deadlines. And, you know, there's an argument to be made for it. I certainly made arguments for it because I was trying to meet everybody's deadlines. But man, I am trying to find a way. Like, and another thing is, like, just in the microcosm of a day, I would stare at the screen for 6 hours straight without getting up, you know, just like, just so in it. It
hurts.
I just don't believe in that anymore, man. Yeah. I don't believe in it. I'm like trying to learn how to go, you know what? I just worked for an hour and a half of like very intense concentration on something.
Yeah.
And I finally go like, I'm learning like, that's okay, enough. That's enough. It's time to take a break. Yeah. Let's shoot some hoops on the little mini basketball hoop on my door and let's talk about the Lord. And when we go back to the thing that we were working on, we will do better. Like,
oh yeah,
we're going to work so much better.
Every time.
I feel like the science backs me up on this, right?
Oh, yeah. No,
which is so true of anything that God has commanded. It's like the, you know.
Wait, no, wait. It's actually
you good mean it's for
true?
You.
You mean it's verifiable by other means than spiritual platitudes?
Spoons. Why, I only have so many spoons. That's amazing. That's so true. I only have so many spoons. And I think one gets taken away every year.
Oh, no. Know? Yeah, don't say that.
You know what I mean?
I agree, though. And I just, yeah, I'm just thinking about the life I have ahead of me to live. But anyway, this was fun. I love just getting to go in all sorts of different
directions. That's awesome. So perfectly unafraid.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com, and to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.